Today, enter the banking crisis, the DFA Daily to the 16th of April 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest posts covering finance and proper news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The health issue is now triggering a good old-fashioned banking crisis, with some of the world's largest banks posting multi-billion dollar losses. This is a reality check for the markets ahead of the broader reporting season in the US. JP Morgan Chase posted a first quarter loss of $2.9 billion, 69%, as it set aside a record $8.2 billion for loan defaults, up $6.8 billion from the previous year, in a move that reflects, quote, deterioration in the macroeconomic environment due to the pandemic and continued pressure on oil prices. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, said that the first quarter had presented the bank with unprecedented challenges. The lender witnessed record demand for revolving credit facilities as the health crisis deepened. Companies drew on their credit lines at probably twice the rate than in the financial crisis of 2008, Dimon said on the earnings conference call. I think companies are very rationally getting their liquidity in order ahead of what could be a significant downturn. The $4.4 billion increase in its consumer reserves was predominantly in cards, while the $2.4 billion increase in its wholesale reserves was spread across oil and gas, real estate, and consumer and retail industries. Recognizing the extraordinary extension of new credit and knowing there will be a major recession means that we are exposing ourselves to billions of dollars of additional credit losses as we help both consumers and businesses through these difficult times, said Jamie Dimon. The bank also flagged an extremely adverse scenario where GDP contracted by 35% and it would consider suspending its dividend based on extreme prudence and uncertainty about the future. And while it entered the crisis in a position of strength, COVID-19 will continue to bite its bottom line. We now have delivered record results in 9 of the last 10 years and are confident we will continue to do so in the future, though it should be expected that our earnings will be down meaningfully in 2020, he said. And JP Morgan's economists now predict US unemployment will soar to 20% in the second quarter before recovering in the final 6 months of the year, with an annualized GDP contraction of 40% in the April-June period. And meanwhile, Wells Fargo posted a first quarter loss of 89% or $2.5 billion after setting aside $4 billion for loan loss provisions, up $3.2 billion from the first quarter 2019. Wells Fargo plays an important role in the financial system and the economic strength of our country, and we take our responsibility seriously, particularly in these unprecedented times, said CEO Charles Schwab. Wells Fargo's commercial clients utilized $80 billion of their loan commitments in March. And Wells Fargo is also bracing for trouble, earmarking $3.1 billion to protect against bad loans. The reserve built at Wells Fargo reflected the impact these unprecedented times could have on our customers, the CFO said in a statement. These big banks have an excellent vantage point from which to observe the fallout from the current situation. They have real-time data on credit use, as well as business and consumer behavior. And I have to say they are closer to the market than the IMF economists that we discussed yesterday. And Morgan Stanley is due to report earnings later today, US time, and is likely on track for its worst session since the 1st of April, down 3.7% after Goldman Sachs missed earnings expectations in its earnings report, partly due to reserve builds. FICC and equities net revenue at Goldman were historically strong, while their asset management division results were weaker. Morgan Stanley has recently generated more of their revenues from asset management than has Goldman, which could account for part of the weakness in its shares. But as Zero Hedge put it, These provision amounts are nowhere near enough if history is any indication. What if instead of using JP Morgan as a benchmark, you take the financial crisis as a reference? After all, we already know that both GDP and unemployment will be far, far worse in the second quarter compared to even the worst levels of the financial crisis a decade plus ago. In the last financial crisis, most banks reserved total losses anywhere between 4 and 6% of total loans. This time around, so far, it's less than 2%. This means that there is a reason why banks did not want to discuss their future provisions, because they know very well that if the financial crisis is a template, there is a long way to go before banks are properly provisioned. And we expect that bank losses will soar by double digits across most of the sectors in a horrible ghost of 2009. So to put it all in context, so far the big four banks have reserved an additional $24 billion in the first quarter for future losses. But if the GFC is any indication of the defaults that are about to be unleashed, the real amount of losses, discharges and delinquencies will be 3 to 4 times compared to the current baseline, meaning that over the next several quarters, banks will have to take another $75 to $100 billion in reserves on loans that go bad, wiping out years of profits, which were used not for a rainy day fund, but to pay for by banks. This, to put it mildly, is a major problem for banks, which until now were seen as generously overcapitalized, because if the US banking sector is facing $100 billion or so in loan losses, then the Fed will have no choice but once again to step in and bail out the US financial sector. But here's the question. Should the Fed reward companies for not having a rainy day fund, removing default risk in the name of a pandemic? Now, there's no right answer here necessarily. The economy is in a shutdown mess, and there needs to be some financial action on both monetary and fiscal sides to help to avoid a prolonged recession or even depression. But there are, however, some good questions after the lessons of the financial crisis. Should companies not have known that eventually there would be another black swan event? In fact, could it have been predicted? Financial advisors tout that personal savings need 3 to 6 months of savings in case of something terrible happening, like losing a job unexpectedly or an illness. How have major corporations not gotten the same message? It's been irresponsible and outrageous that companies could borrow debt to buy back stock in their own companies. The proportion of buybacks in 2016 and 2017 funded by corporate bonds reached as high as 30%, according to JP Morgan Chase. Many of those companies are now looking for taxpayer-funded money to get them out of a few months of expenses. What could have helped companies survive something like the coronavirus would have been saving the $730 billion that were spent last year on buybacks, and you could add in the expected $321 billion for 2020, and there you have $1 trillion stashed away to help stave off a sharp economic collapse. If they hadn't bought back those stocks, then maybe the taxpayer would not have had to fund companies' bailout packages. We are right back in too-big-to-fail territory. When push came to shove in 2020 and companies were forced to shut down, the government and the Fed had to step in to provide financial support to the same companies that bought back billions of their stocks. Perhaps if you can't survive 6 to 12 months without revenue after operating for more than 10 years, you should be allowed to fail. Perhaps you were irresponsible with your spending. And isn't that how capitalism is meant to work? Otherwise, we are going to create massive moral hazard problems coming out of the current crisis. And talking of moral hazards, the recent Fed action includes supporting junk bonds. Not that they will buy them outright, but it will buy exchange-traded funds that own those junk bonds to provide liquidity. And if that's not a transfer from taxpayers and future taxpayers to currently wealthy people and companies, then I don't know what is. The Fed is currently discounting how the politics of these bailouts are going to cause a fallout way larger than the financial crisis, especially with how much easier information flows these days. Given how big the populist movements have been in the last decade, we wonder whether this will inflame or calm down those concerns when there's mass unemployment on the streets, but the billionaires are getting away with it again and getting bailed out. The underlying problem of corporate obsession with short-term price performance has put US households at risk in a boom or bust economy. And you can read that across directly to Australia too in my book. And locally, Bendigo and Adelaide Bank announced that given the level of uncertainty created by the pandemic, it's withdrawn its previously advised second half 20 outlook commentary. Now, there are no surprises about today's announcement, but we do expect many more to do this ahead. And again, locally, we don't think that banks have yet started to calibrate the true losses they should expect to see ahead. Early sign of trouble was highlighted by Clancy Yates at the SMH. He wrote that according to mortgage brokers, banks have started to tighten credit from pandemic-hit workers. Banks have become more wary about lending to workers in industries hit by the virus outbreak, mortgage brokers say, as the pandemic leads to tighter credit conditions in the $1.7 trillion home loan market. Several major lenders have this month implemented tighter vetting of prospective customers in response to the pandemic, with brokers reporting banks being cautious towards borrowers from hospitality, airlines, tourism, and parts of retail. Mortgage Choice Chief Executive Susan Mitchell said it's tightening for some. In a sign of banks' greater caution, Ms. Mitchell said some lenders were checking customers were still employed days before loans were due to be settled. This is something lenders have always had the legal right to do, but it has not typically happened in the past. After unconditional approval, they'll still go back and verify you're employed, she said. Commonwealth Bank, Macquarie Group and ING have told mortgage brokers this month of temporary changes in their lending processes in response to the virus, and brokers say there is an industry-wide trend of greater caution. The precise changes vary between banks, but some lenders are cutting back on how much income from overtime borrowers can declare on their loan applications, while others are limiting how much debt borrowers can take out to access the equity in their home. The trends come amid strong growth in refinancing as wholesale broker AFG on Wednesday reported a record value of loan applications lodged with banks in March. AFG Chief Executive David Bailey said it was reasonable to say banks were being more cautious in their new lending decisions in light of the economic threats and uncertainties. It comes down to the responsible lending provisions and the outlook on the virus. And the question is, at the time the loan is being drawn down, are the responsible lending conditions being maintained, Mr. Bailey said. Ms. Mitchell and Mr. Bailey both said that at the same time, refinancing activity was strong, helped by low fixed rate offers from banks in the last month. In changes due to take effect from Thursday this week, Macquarie has said that it will have additional income and employment verification requirements from all applications, and it is tightening access to equity release loans with loan-to-valuation ratios above 70%, while offering cut price interest rates on loans with LVRs below 60%. And Commonwealth Bank said it would temporarily ask home loan applicants more questions about potential risk to their finances. And ING Direct said this week that it would not consider income from self-employed people working in industries such as airlines, tourism, hospitality or retail. When banks tightened credit to property investors and interest-only customers between 2015 and 2019, it drove a downturn in the housing market. A managing director of HomeLoanExperts.com said that unlike the last episode of Tighter Credit, the bank's main focus this time was on borrowers' incomes. It really targets around income this time. That's where the risk is. Lenders are asking more questions generally. They're making fewer exceptions on policy. And while banks had not put formal policies on high LVR loans, he said, it was very hard to get one approved. Confidence in property markets has tumbled across all asset classes, according to a Property Council release today. The rapid fall in confidence is unsurprising, with markets across the board reacting to the economic fallout created by the virus. 54% of respondents in Victoria indicated that the virus outbreak would have a serious impact on their businesses over the next 3 months. An additional 35% said they were maintaining business as usual in construction and planning. The property industry paid more than $21 billion in total wages and salaries, employed one in four Victorian workers, and they said they're working with the government to keep as many people working for as long as possible. But the flash report from our household surveys indicates that households' expectation of future price growth has collapsed in less than a month, with those intending to borrow or to transact falling to unprecedented low levels. And one of the major factors is the uncertainty about future job prospects. And we'll provide further information in a separate post, but this is precisely the indicators that we expected to see in the ABS, released some meaningless unemployment data today, showing unemployment lifted from 5.2% from 5.1%, and there was a small gain in employment, with the participation rate flat at 66%. But the ABS emphasised that the reference period for the March survey was in the first 2 weeks of the month before the lockdowns really cut in. And therefore, don't read too much into the small rise or the small movement in the unemployment rate. We're going to expect to see a much more significant deterioration in the April survey. And we think the underemployment rate, which has been rising from a low of 8.3 up to 8.8% in March, is going to be a more significant indicator ahead, because there will be many people on JobKeeper's arrangements that will be underemployed. So that will be probably a better leading indicator, because of course you won't be officially unemployed if you are on a JobKeeper program. But the latest ANZ Roy Morgan consumer confidence read came out today, and they said that confidence has strengthened compared with the prior week, with a jump of more than 10% strength of broad base, with current financial conditions up 8.7%, while future financial conditions were up 7.9%. And the inflation expectations fell just a little to 4%. Now, this survey is based on 1,492 interviews conducted online and over the telephone in the weekend. And they said that the flattening of the pandemic curve is helping to give consumers a little more confidence, and they're up 20% from the historic low reached over the last weekend in March. But despite this, it is still some way below the level seen at the GFC, and sentiment is likely to remain in the doldrums for a long time, because business confidence and conditions are worsening, and there's going to be more bad news ahead. And as the conversation discussed today, the New Zealand community has got behind an elimination strategy for the virus, with reported cases having peaked 89 in April, is now declining. And they have averted a health system overload in New Zealand. Now, there have been some rule breakers who the Prime Minister Ardern called idiots, but people have been generally supportive of the government's efforts, and in fact, a poll found that 88% were supportive of what they were doing. Now, this is significantly higher than in some other countries, including the UK, the US and Canada, as well as Japan. And I think we can learn a lot from New Zealand, and frankly, I think we should be following the same path here. As Norman Swan from the ABC has been saying, we could chart a path to zero, and this could well be the quickest way to get back our economy, because we have to stop thinking about the COVID as a super flu and understand that it is much closer to SARS. And Asian countries who experienced SARS reacted much more aggressively because they understood much more about this type of virus than we do in Australia. But it could well be that our modelling and strategies are based on false assumptions. I think Swan is onto a very important point, and I do believe that aiming for zero is by far the best strategy from this point, despite the fact this would require a stronger lockdown for slightly longer. The fact is, we've done the hard yards, and now we should capitalise on it. And by the way, let me just say one other thing. I've had lots of people ask me to look at the various theories about the origins of the coronavirus and some of the conspiracy theories that are wheeling around the system. Now, I'm not going to enter into those speculative discussions. I'm going to focus on the economic impact and the data that's coming out from the markets and the surrounding areas. If you want to go down various rabbit holes and explore those rather disturbing but nevertheless unverifiable theories that are doing the rounds, then feel free, go elsewhere. You won't find them on this channel. And finally, before I go, I just want to play this short video sequence that Edwin Almeida of Property Insider sent me. This is the worst of the worst, as a real estate agent ends up giving bad financial advice, which they're not allowed to do, and making some outrageous statements with regard to bankruptcies, as though bankruptcy is some way connected to interest rates. This is frankly a disgrace, and I just want to bring it to your attention, because if this is the quality of the discussion going around the traps, then boy, we have an even bigger problem than I thought.
When you have 0% interest rates, people cannot go bankrupt with 0% interest rates. Just remember that, guys. If you think there's going to be some crash on asset prices, on property, the banks are not charging people mortgages. They cannot go bankrupt in this time. So just understand that. People are getting 0% mortgage.
So on today's markets, the ASX 200 ended down 0.92% to 5,416. And the financial index was down 1.35% to 4,293. The ASX futures index is up 1.55% to 5,422. And the volatility index was up 13.15% to 32.55. The Aussie dollar was down 0.32% to 62.98 against the US dollar. And against the euro, we were pretty much flat at 1.7270. The two-year bond was down 4.26% to 0.213. And the 10-year bond was down 3.11% to 0.842. The gold Aussie cross was up 1.48% to 2,735. And the Bitcoin Aussie cross was up 0.74% to 11,020. Last night in New York, the Dow Jones was down 1.86% to 23,504. The S&P 500 was down 2.2% to 2,783. And the Financial Services Index was down 4.37%, not surprising given the poor results. And the Volatility Index was higher, up 1.79% to 41.57. Ahead, the S&P 500 futures is up 0.8% to 2,797. And the NASDAQ futures was up 0.91% to 8,669. So we continue to see the same pressures on the market. And the lack of ability to translate from the real economy back into the financial markets. But the meeting point, I think, will be the banks. And I think this will be the next trigger down for the broader markets, because the financial system and the financial sector is such a large part of the global economy, our economy, and of course the US economy. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again.